From KHOI in Ames, I'm Chris Viviora, and this is Book Central. My guest today is BJ Hollers, author of the new book, Flock Together, A Love Affair with Extinct Birds. BJ pursues lost birds and finds birders sharing his obsession with the change of our world, especially here in the Central Time Zone, specifically Wisconsin, where BJ is an assistant professor of English at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. BJ Hollers, welcome to Book Central.
Thanks so much for having me.
BJ, you open the book with the epigraph, "For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun," by Aldo Leopold from his essay about passenger pigeons. But would you share your first encounter with an extinct bird?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting way to phrase it, my first encounter with an extinct bird, because, of course, a lot of the book is actually about my inability to encounter extinct birds, at least directly. But there's certainly plenty of ways I've encountered them kind of indirectly and through memory and photograph and storytelling. And so I guess my first encounter, the first time I really tried to wrap my head around the idea of extinction related to birds and animals more generally, of course, was the dodo bird, which is sort of the poster child for extinction for a lot of folks, you know, the poster bird, if you will. And just growing up, you know, I remember being a young elementary school student and a teacher just mentioning the dodo, and it blew my mind to hear that there was once a bird that's suddenly not here anymore. I was certain if I just kept searching long enough, eventually we'd find it. It wasn't gone forever. It was just hiding, but turns out it was gone forever.
And I mean, you kind of did your own search for it and didn't find it, and you didn't accept that it was gone.
It's weird. I think it was just, you know, when you're young, the world is so large, you know, and it just seems like it's unfathomable that there's something that was once here that is no longer here. I mean, certainly when you get to learn about dinosaurs, you understand, obviously, the dinosaurs are gone, but birds are something we recognize in our daily lives. You know, I saw robins and blue jays and cardinals on a daily basis. So it was so strange to me after seeing a artist's depiction of the dodo that a bird that looks sort of like a fat chicken couldn't just be roaming around someone's farm somewhere, you know?
Sure.
The world, of course, is so big. Maybe I didn't see it. Maybe my buddy next door didn't see it, but certainly someone somewhere knew where this thing was hiding. And so it was sort of a wake-up call for me when I realized, no one has this in their backyard.
Right, right. And, I mean, you're almost like denial about the dodo bird being gone spurs this curiosity, yours curiosity in the book, of these different sections, which just works wonderfully, of slowly realizing and getting to know birds from glimpsing, spotting, seeing, and then finally getting to know birds that are extinct and endangered and threatened and common. But you kind of mentioned it, is that your spark bird and the bird that got you into birding was a bird that you didn't encounter in real life. It was an extinct bird, which was the passenger pigeon. So when did you first glimpse that bird? How did that become your spark bird? I mean, why an extinct bird?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of two birds. I think in the book I actually call the ivory-billed woodpecker the initial spark bird, but certainly the passenger pigeon too. They both work the same way for me, you know. And of course, spark bird refers to kind of the entry point bird into the world of birding. So a lot of the birders often talk about the bird that got them most interested in all of this. And for me, it was sort of both of those birds, different extents. So for me, the ivory billed was sort of interesting, just because it allegedly reemerged in 2004, 2005. There was an enormous search that was conducted. All the swampland was covered. All of these incredibly well-known birders and ornithologists throughout the country came together to find this thing. And yet, despite their best efforts, they kind of wound up with less evidence than we'd hoped for. And I want to give them a lot of credit. You know, I'd much prefer our scientists giving this a shot rather than ignoring the possibility altogether.
Right.
And so I was intrigued simply because I remember picking up an old copy of USA Today when I was in college and seeing there on, like, you know, one of the pages, this rare, or this extinct bird was allegedly found. And I thought, oh my goodness, maybe there's a chance in the world things could still exist. And passenger pigeon, to a different extent, served as a spark bird because I was a little closer to it, despite the fact that it has been gone since 1914.
Sure.
Here on our UW Eau Claire campus, we have this bird museum. It's all dead birds. They're stuffed. But it was really cool when I was wandering through there one day between classes, just killing a bit of time. There were three passenger pigeons stuffed right there, less than a quarter mile from my office. And so it was really neat for me to realize right here, there are still at least some remnants of a bird that's no longer with us. Although once, not too long ago, 100 years prior, 125, 30 years prior, they had flocked directly over corridors of this town and many other Midwestern towns, just like it, blotting out the sun.
Right. And, I mean, it was really interesting reading about your encounter with that passenger pigeon at the Clark Bird Museum. I mean, there was a bit of an oddity of this extinct bird that was falling apart. And I don't know, it made me think about, there was an Ames Historical Society member who mentioned how there's a certain point in time where things first began being archived and preserved. But before that, there wasn't that kind of forethought because everything was used up or reused, if anything of it even remained. And I mean, I don't think that the passenger pigeon was the first bird to be saved after death. Obviously, you know, we knew about the dodo and that was much before that. But it seems like it was the one that really signified our loss, not just our human loss, but our world's loss of an entire bird that, like you said, once blotted out the sky.
Right. I think that really nails it. And I think the reason the passenger pigeon is sort of a maybe second-generation dodo poster bird to a, maybe a more modern audience is because it was really everywhere. It was the most ubiquitous bird in the United States for quite some time. We went from the bird species with the most birds to total extinction in 40 years in half a human's lifetime. And that's such a staggering thing to think about, you know, how we birds went from billions to none is often the soundbite you hear when people talk about it in a matter of 40 years. You know, people would kill them in any number of ways. They had nets, they had fire, they would stomp them with boots, they would just fill barrels, send these barrels on trains, and ship them out for food and other purposes. And it was just a commodity. You know, there were so many that people thought we could kill them forever, you know, and then people started to realize there's a limit to how many we kill before not only are they not limitless, but we have none left to continue our own kind of bird-related economy here. So it's a sad story of human intervention utterly taking a bird off the map forever. We did it. It's not necessarily a biological thing or a change in evolutionary practices for the bird. It was just something we did. We chose to do it, and we did it fully.
And, I mean, even the technology aided us in doing it. I mean, you mentioned about the telegraph and the train that we could take ourselves out to where the birds were, these massive, you know, flocks of them, and then additionally hear about it and slaughter them. So it compounded our fault, I guess. And it's interesting that the book opens with that Aldo Leopold quote about the passenger pigeon, and it's about that monument to our fault. I don't know if you can speak to about finding that and how it felt to see this, I don't know, this testament that instead of celebrating, grieves.
Yeah, that's really well put. The man who's really done a lot of research on, especially the role of technology in the pursuit of passenger pigeons, is a guy named Joel Greenberg. And I spent a little time with him. I've since gone birding with him. He's really taught me a lot about the loss and what that loss means, you know. And so when I went out in this cold, snowy January morning to you know, hike up this hill to find this monument, I was, I think, the only person in the entire park, Wyalusing State Park in southwestern Wisconsin here. So here I am kind of with my binoculars bouncing on my chest, complete stillness, you know, maybe 7-8 inches of snow on the ground. I was really concerned I wouldn't even be able to drive out of there. It was quite wintry conditions, you know. But when you finally made it to the top, when I made it to the top, the desolation was humbling in some ways. I tried to envision the birds there. This was very much a corridor for them, and the skies were just silent. I mean, nothing, no movement beyond, you know, the occasional snowflake drifting from the trees. And so I kind of felt like some poetic justice. I'd come all this way, not necessarily to see birds, but hopefully to see some confirmation of nature. And all I saw was sort of the silence that nature was willing to give me. There was no sign of any animal, no track in the snow. It was just the blank snow on the ground. And so it definitely stirred something within me. And I think that was the moment when this project really became more important to me. It wasn't just the lark. It wasn't just something I was sort of interested in. It became more of a calling.
Right. And I mean, that monument, too, shows off that we're not forgiven for what we did.
That's a very good point. We're not. And here's here's proof, you know, look it in the face, look what you did, look what those who came before you did. And so the park ranger I talked to mentioned how sometimes folks come up, they're not realizing what's up there. They're just hiking the trail, you know, and they see it and their jaws drop. And then you think, wait, what? Why is this here? Because it's kind of disconcerting for a monument to kind of directly face you in that way, and you're forced to take it in. You're forced to acknowledge to some extent, you know, maybe it wasn't you, but predecessors, our human race, were the reason the birds all turned into a monument. That's all we have left.
Yeah. And so, you know, the passenger pigeon is completely wiped out, except for maybe some cloning ideas I've heard about. But the other bird you obsess over, and you did mention it, obviously, is this kind of dual spark bird, the passenger pigeon and this other one in flock together, which is nicknamed Lord God, which, you know, continuing on with that kind of not being forgiven, it seemed like, I thought about it as I was reading, was that it's a prayer, Lord God, but it could also be a curse. And what's interesting you had mentioned is it might or might not be extinct. You know, can you tell me about that bird, obviously the ivory bill, and what you think about it still being here or not? Because you really fall on one side, but you also say that you don't mind if you're corrected. And maybe whether you think its nickname really is a prayer or a curse, what would be your take on it?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, too. I mean, when I think of the possibility of one day stumbling upon an ivory-billed woodpecker in the world, you know, for me it would be a prayer. It would be that, Lord God, you know, like my, I can feel myself trembling a bit just saying those words and imagining that scene, you know. But certainly there's a debate, and I would say an ongoing debate, about whether or not the ivory-billed woodpecker is indeed extinct. You know, technically it's it's endangered. We don't have it as the status isn't technically extinct, primarily because if you make an animal extinct from a status perspective, then there are no protections in the event that bird or that animal were to suddenly reemerge. So
it'd be like a zombie,
you know,
bird, right?
Exactly. we need to have a possibility of it being here if it, in case it does return. So it has some protections. But you know, this is a weird book to write, because as I make pretty clear in the introduction, I'm no ornithologist. I'm very much a budding birder. I'm just a guy who one morning woke up and realized, oh my goodness, you know, the world is filled with birds. Where have you been all my life? And of course, it's always been here. I just never bothered to look up in the trees. And when you start noticing, suddenly you can't help but see them everywhere, and you can't help but keep a bird book in your back pocket and your, you know, your binoculars in the car, and, you know, pull to the side of the road every once in a while. And so since I am an amateur, I didn't want to make any major rulings personally on whether or not it existed, but I did trace the story as best I could. And, you know, most scientists would agree that it's very, very unlikely that the bird continues to exist. There are some statistics, you know, not quite one in a million, but they aren't a whole lot better than that.
Sure.
Nonetheless, you know, the dreamer in me, the poet in me, the writer in me, and I guess the X-Files fan in me, I want to believe, you know, I really do want to believe. And so I've written about different types of species, and even a little about, you know, cryptozoology, Bigfoot, that sort of thing, more in a tongue-in-cheek manner. But even then, it was always about, I want to live in a world with the potential that we could be wrong, that humans might have missed something, and that, you know, maybe there are a couple ivory-billed woodpeckers in some Louisiana swamp somewhere. There's a lot more land unexplored than explored. You know, I always give the example of, in, you know, the early 2000s, something like 50,000 lowland gorillas were found 50 miles outside the nearest road in Africa. I mean, that's just 50 miles off a road, and here's a treasure trove of 50,000 gorillas we never knew were there. I mean, it's incredible to think about that. And so it kind of just warms my heart to think, you know, there's a lot of land out there that's still sort of unexplored, still pretty wild. And, you know, maybe there's a pair of ivory bills up there with a nest and maybe a couple eggs inside.
Right. I mean, as I was reading it, I grew up in Central Florida, and that's one of the last places that it might have been spotted, other than Arkansas later on. And I actually canoed the Wakaiva River, where the ivory bill used to be. And I was reading it, as I was reading your book, I was reimagining paddling along, you know, the lily pads, keeping an eye out for the gators, and thinking, like, what if this, like, you know, woodpecker swooped out of the cypress at the water's edge and, you know, made that call? And I don't know if I would have thought it was a prayer or it was this haunting curse that, you know, they're still around and we have this responsibility to them. That definitely would have been amazing. But man, I don't know what would happen if it was on my end. We're going to have to take a short break here, but we're going to continue in just a moment. You're listening to Book Central on KHOI and Ames. This program is supported by Humanities Iowa and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The views and opinions expressed by this program do not necessarily reflect those of Humanities Iowa or the National Endowment for the Humanities. We're back. If you're joining us, my guest today is BJ Hollers, author of Flock Together. Before the break, we were talking about different extinct birds, including the passenger pigeon and ivory-billed woodpecker, that BJ sought to find despite them being lost. So, BJ, what's interesting in your book, Flock Together, is that it takes you a while to get out of the office, archives, museums, and in the woods to actually go birding. And it seems like Steve Bechtol really took you under his wing, and obviously pun intended. How did he do that? You know, get you out, to pull you away from the desk and get you outside in the woods?
Yeah, Steve was a huge help. I think every budding birder needs a Steve Bechtol in his or her life, you know.
Kind of like a Lorax of the birds.
Kind of like the Lorax of the birds. That's exactly how I view him, you know. He cares so deeply for these creatures, for all creatures and the environment generally. And frankly, I didn't have a lot of folks in my life who could speak to that subject, you know. I suppose I'm an academic to some extent. Certainly I teach at the university level, but I really wanted to move beyond the desk. And everything I write, I really want to move beyond the armchair researcher role and get out there. I want to get in the canoe. I want to get in the treetops, wherever I got to be to find these birds. That's where I want to be. And so Dee was really generous. And I think he really wanted someone like me, someone who had a lot of enthusiasm, but not a lot of, back knowledge related to this, background information to get out there with him. So he could help let me hear what he hears and identify based on a song, based on a glimmer or a glimpse you see in a tree. And that's what he's so good at. But for me, it was a real joy just to learn bird by bird alongside him.
Yeah, and I mean, do you remember any specific, like your first time you went out with Steve or one that really struck you? I know later on you went on that big bird census over the winter to count the birds. But just you and Steve, was there one time, or I'm sure that there were more than one, but was there one time that stood out to you where you felt he was really helping you become a birder yourself?
Well, several occasions, and it's funny how they really resonate in my head. I mean, you always remember the first time you see a bird, a particular bird. And so one morning, I believe it was on one of the Christmas bird counts, it was, you know, dawn, 7 in the morning at the latest. We're kind of driving around these rural roads in Wisconsin, very cold, a little bit of mist out there, and there was a ring-necked pheasant that kind of just bolted past us, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I'd never seen one of those before, you know, and I wasn't expecting to see one, and it was there maybe 3 seconds tops running across the road, you know, and it was just so cool to know its name immediately. Like if I was alone, I would have garbled a couple things out and referred to my book and figured it out eventually, you know, but he knows it without any doubt. And even if he doesn't see it, he can hear it and know it without any doubt. And so, I mean, having him around is like having the best bird guide at your disposal, but, you know, it's a human being and he can he can tell you why he knows it and how he knows it. So there's a lot of learning that goes on there.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously there are probably so many moments with Steve, and there are probably ones that didn't make it into the book. I feel like he's a guy who's, I mean, verbose in a good way, opinionated, passionate. I mean, he could probably be the subject of an entire book.
I sure hope so. You know, I mean, for me, and the reason it's titled as it is, Flock Together, it's because I'm trying to draw the connection between birds and humans, you know, both from an ecological standpoint, but also kind of in a more personal nature. And so Steve takes solace in the birds. He has so much appreciation for them. He sees so much value in birds and what they do for nature and what nature does for birds. And a lot of us just kind of go through our daily lives ignoring all of that, you know. And I think up till 2 years ago, I was right there with him. I've changed. It's weird how I've changed. I used to walk around, you know, earbuds in, listen to mm-hmm. a podcast everywhere I went. Mm-hmm. And I still do that on occasion, but now when I'm walking the dog around the block, I spend a lot more time just, you know, peeking around trees. Sometimes I have my binoculars around my neck. And it's just, there's something about the encounter and the interaction in life, in real, authentic life, that just is more interesting and engaging to me than any podcast, you know. And so it's been cool to see how truly my life is different. I like to mow the lawn a little more because it gives me a chance to be outside. I like to grill out a little more because, again, it gets me out of the house. So there's a lot of times when you're doing something else outside, mm-hmm. When you're also sort of secretly birding. That's been a great way for me to appreciate nature a little more.
Sure. And I mean, you know, it's interesting. You didn't have this example of a mentor. I can definitely feel that, too. I've had two examples of that happen where I remember walking with my aunt once, and she pointed out a flower and I guessed it wrong. And she kind of like shamed me into not knowing it. And I thought, well, where were you? You were supposed to tell me the names of these flowers. Well, you know, I've also been with one woman who just talks to the flowers as if she knows that she's a master gardener. So she really does know the flowers, but she'll just talk about them as not if they're people, but their scientific name, their common name. You know, you'll walk through a garden and she'll point them out. And I've realized that it's about educating the other person and bringing them into that conversation. And you have this happen too in the book where you didn't get the mentoring occur, but you share your passion with your son, Henry. And, you know, there's this moment that you recall about hearing an owl outside your house and you bring Henry to watch for it. But then you realize the owl is hunting a rabbit and you've made this faux pas of first telling Henry that the owl is Owl from Winnie the Pooh. But then rabbit would be rabbit and you don't want to have the blood of the death of your kid's imaginary world on your hands. And, you know, can you tell me what happened and how you balanced the conflict between the natural order of the world and the innocence of your son and mentoring him in this natural, you know, birding experience?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's a good example of how this whole book kind of came together. I mean, I really wanted this to be kind of part research, part memoir, you know. And so as I was writing this book, there were always these moments when the personal would kind of intersect with the more research moments. And that's a great thing for the book. I think I really want to be a guide, as little as I know, to help other kind of budding birders and other readers of nature writing generally, or nonfiction generally, just to, you know, have a part, have a role, have this other kind of novice guy as a guide. And for me, I'm that novice guy for my son, you know. And so he was literally about to go to bed. His eyes were heavy. My wife just finished reading him a book.
And there I
am reading papers. And I pop up and I run out and I grab him. And next thing I know, we're out in the front yard. We're in the backyard. We're watching this whole horrific, dramatic scene play out. And spoiler alert, the rabbit was okay for that particular moment.
You're just like, rabbit, go, rabbit, run.
And you always hear like you're never supposed to interfere with nature or let it take its course, but oh, geez, I needed that rabbit to live one more night, you know.
Right. And I'm sure you've probably taken Henry, and there's some other points in the book too of where you take him out and about. Do you find yourself teaching him the birds that you now know?
You know, I'm trying, and I think back, you know, and I hadn't thought about this when I was writing it, but it's because my dad did the same. I mean, my dad kind of grew up in an agrarian rural life, never went to college, but even today he can pretty much name every bird and every flower that you pass, you know. And so growing up, I never really appreciated that. And then now, you know, here I am the college professor, but I have so little of that knowledge, you know, and he has so much. And so I started to realize, you know, what kind of dad am I if I can't name that flower, name that tree for my own son? I can't even get a fish off a hook very well. You know, I had to get my father act together. And I think more than just teaching my son about the animals and the trees and the birds is also kind of our stewardship toward these things. And so that's, for me, what's most important is that is a beautiful flower, Henry, and here's why we need to protect it. And here's why we don't pick it. And here's why we put bird food in the feeder. And here's why we, you know, we never interfere with the nest. And so there are little lessons that are good reminders for all of us, but also an opportunity to kind of show my own young son the importance of being stewards for what will soon be his world.
Sure. And I mean, that moment with you and Henry is in the same chapter with Francis Zier, this hermit guy from a century ago. I mean, you quote in the epigraph to the chapter saying, and this is a great like combination of humanity and animals that we're not different, is that the only foolish animal is the man, because he would be less so if he would realize that he is an animal. And like you said, we seem to have this difficulty with being out in the world. Earbuds plopped in, screens hypnotizing us. And I wondered if Zier, this is this challenge, or maybe this wake up to us or to you to plug back into the world and plug out of what we've plugged ourselves into, the technology that kind of masks us.
Yeah, I mean, when I stumbled across these letters that Francis Zier left behind, again, he was this hermit. He lived out in nature with his wife. After she died, he was all alone. And most of his relationships were with nature, were with animals. And so the only person that he kind of, I think, regularly communicated with, or at least communicated with the most, was a UW-Madison professor named Bill Shorter, who happened to be the, you know, world scholar on passenger pigeons. And so they would write these beautiful letters back and forth for, you know, maybe 15 years or so. And a lot of these letters are still in the archive. And so when I stumbled upon them, I was just mesmerized, especially by what Zier was writing. Here's a guy who was not hampered by anything of our current world. You know, he lived in a cabin and he, you know, had himself a fire and he tried to keep the cabin warm, and he spent his whole day, you know, just taking care of the daily needs of life, and would often go out at night roaming the woods and checking out the animals and writing about these beautiful encounters. And, you know, after a whole lifetime of this, he published, you know, maybe a handful of articles, and they're all just poetry, you know, an untrained nature writer who just knew it better than anyone else because he lived it daily. And so he really is someone I sort of admire. I think modern world would say, you know, what a strange guy that was. Mm-hmm. Certainly living in that way wouldn't be for everyone, myself included, but that doesn't mean we still can't have a lot of admiration and appreciation for a guy who can do that and can say no to the extravagances and trappings of the modern world and instead just, you know, spend some time examining the world for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great example for sure, and kind of like this counter to life in our technology world, life in the past. And you encounter him through the letters and also eventually visit his cabin. And you also got to know him through him staying in place. That 15 years or more, actually, he lived, I call it like deep field work, kind of like deep ecology, where he got to know the lands and the birds. That's some kind of loyalty to the land that he invested.
Absolutely. You know, when I think of that phrase, loyalty of the land, I think of Wendell Berry, who's another writer I really admire, who really delves deep into that idea of, you know, trying to have great reverence for an actual spot on the map and to do things to ensure that that spot is protected for future generations. And there is a great loyalty, I think, for Zier. He lived in primarily in Hayward, Wisconsin, and Birchwood, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I was just driving by Birchwood not too long ago, and I kept thinking, gosh, is that where the goshawk was? Is that where the cabin was? And of course, we don't really know today where exactly.
Right, and the goshawk was the hawk that him and Bill were writing back and forth about, and then he sent him a shot, stuffed bird to him, right?
Correct, and the northern goshawk is this very rare bird at that time in Wisconsin, and he has been credited with the first sighting of the northern goshawk in Wisconsin, and so it was sort of a secret he kept for a while. And then he brought some folks from a Milwaukee museum in, and it became a little less secretive. And then he himself, Zier himself, actually shot one of the birds to send to Bill Shorter as a kind of gift. He was so proud that he found this bird, but it also kind of broke his heart from what I gleaned. You know, he really did not like to shoot animals if he didn't have to, let alone something as rare and beautiful as the goshawk.
Right. And I mean, that's the kind of relationship that comes together in this book. And we're going to take another short break here. You're listening to Book Central on KHOI in Ames.
Well, you can call me Falcon, and you can say to my face, I live on the moon, every natural place. No
Support for this program is provided by Plot Twist Bookstore in Ankeny, a place where book lovers can browse, talk, and meet. Open daily. For hours and more information, go to plottwistbookstore.com. We're back. I'm continuing my conversation with BJ Hollers, author of Flock Together. Before the break, we were talking about people who led BJ to birds, as well as his own explorations with family and his relationship with the outdoors of Wisconsin. BJ, you write in the book, since we don't know the names of things, we don't have a problem forgetting they exist. So we've got this responsibility to know birds, to go beyond glimpsing them, to taking the time to spot them and see them, hear their songs, and finally know them so we don't forget them. And I always think about all these parallels between birding and writing and reading. What were some of the parallels between birding and writing for you, maybe birding and reading, or maybe differences?
Yeah, well, I guess the one that comes to mind right away has to do with the extinct birds, and that is quite like writing. It's such an elusive process. You never quite see what you want to see. It never quite goes the way you planned it, you know. And so even with this book, you know, in a lot of cases, I had a neatly mapped outline of where I was going to go and what I was going to see. And, you know, I mean, frankly, one version of this book had me out in a canoe in some swamps in Arkansas. I was going to take a road trip to Brinkley. I was going to talk to the folks in the city. And, you know, I just couldn't quite get it all worked out. And
try to find the ivory bill, right?
I was going to find it. I was going to go out there and find the thing no one else could find. But barring that, you know, I ended up at the Chicago Field Museum, and I ended up holding a study skin of an ivory-billed woodpecker. And it was weird holding this dead, extinct bird. And yet for me, it was also kind of a cathartic moment. It wasn't quite the same as seeing the real deal, perhaps. But nonetheless, it got me as close as I would probably ever get to one. And so that was my attempt to come as close as I could, which is sort of the theme of the book.
Yeah, of getting out and trying to find them. And it almost ended up being similar, maybe the same as the passenger pigeon, another stuffed bird, and a stuffed bird that's kind of what we're left with is the embalmed body of what's left of these birds.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the best we can do. You can go see the monument. You can go see some stuffed examples of the bird. You can read Aldo Leopold's take on the birds and original reports of what it sounded like when he flew overhead and what it looked like visually, and, you know, a painting or two that exists, but it's not enough. None of it quite, you know, fills my desire to see one fly, you know, see one roosting in a tree. And yet we are sort of left with kind of secondhand versions of these animals. And so I think part of my journey of just showing readers, here's all we got left, is a way to say, look, readers, we can prevent this from happening to our own birds that are still with us today. We don't want to be left just with a monument again.
And, I mean, you mentioned one part that you didn't end up doing, but I'm sure as you're getting to know birds, you're probably thinking about telling the story about getting to know them. Were there any birding moments that when you were experiencing them, you knew you were also witnessing them to write about later, that you knew in that moment, like, oh, I'm going to write about this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There were moments like that, and the one that comes to mind involves these dog walks. You know, I got this dog. We take our daily morning walk, and so I got to know the crows across the street, the murder of crows. You know,
right.
Every morning they would just have at us, just squawking away, you know, and really giving us the business. And I had this, you know, 14-pound black dog, so it's not like he wouldn't maybe be a little bit of a threat to her. You know, she was nervous. She was barking back. You were really giving each other quite the time. And so I knew that was sort of a metaphor, in some extent of my relationship with my birds. You know, it was fraught in some extent. You know, no matter how hard I tried, I would never know these birds fully, the ones that were extinct. And even the ones in my own backyard, it often required a second glance. It required me to, you know, flip through my birding guide just to make sure I knew the difference between, you know, a finch and a house sparrow, which seems silly to most birders, you know, but I'm not a great birder. That's sort of the honest truth of it. I think I learned that, but I also learned how much I appreciate folks who are, and at least if I have nothing else, I have the ability to marvel at the creatures, at their world that they inhabit, and just want to be as much a part of it as I can without intruding upon it.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely took on the honesty of being an amateur in it, or just a beginner, you know, maybe not even an amateur. And having fun with just the language of the book and making sure to attach yourself, get under the wing, like what we talked about, Steve, that he really mentored you out there. So you definitely, I think, got yourself out of the desk into the woods and got to know the birds around you. Don't you think that's maybe the first step for people who just want to find out about birds is look out your window?
Look out your window, you know, and it's sort of like a gateway drug. You know, once you look out your window, the next thing you're going to want to do is, you know, drive 50 miles to the state park, you know, and then maybe you'll want to go to a larger park and maybe get a couple of buddies involved. And the next thing you know, you're waking up at dawn looking for sandhill cranes 3 hours away, you know, and that's a wonderful experience too. And so I guess if I could encourage readers to do anything, it would be to really lower the bar. You don't have to know the names of all the birds when you're starting. Clearly, I still don't know all the names of all the birds. There's that many of them. But just being able to experience them, to witness them, I mean, there's some great satisfaction in that. And then a different level of gratification for me came when I could begin saying, oh, look, son, that's a so-and-so. And that was powerful for me for, you know, personal reasons. But also, I knew the bird better. I could name it. And I felt that meant sort of a relationship was being born there, you know. But even if you can't name a cardinal, even if we can't even get the basics down, that doesn't mean you can't appreciate seeing one at your feet or outside the window, and that's certainly the first step.
Sure. And with birding, it usually is this quiet and observational practice that seems almost like a philosophical practice or meditation, like reading. It's difficult to defend, at least I feel that way. Not that people think that, you know, reading or birding is bad, but it's difficult to do in America, the land of distraction and noise. And, you know, you bird in solitude mostly, except maybe with birding census counts or buddies. And how do you not get lonely while out there? Or can you make it easy for yourself or not? Is it not supposed to be easy?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I mean, what I'll say is every time I actually, you know, do unplug and get in the car and I get up early and grab my cup of coffee and go out there and see what's flying around the skies, I never regret it. You know, I mean, I could use that time, you know, watching a movie on Netflix, you know, maybe cracking a book. And those would be fine ways to spend an early morning, you know, maybe getting some of my own writing done, which is often how I spend my early mornings. But I would never regret a moment when I took the other route and got out early for a little hike or, you know, just to even just sit in the backyard and drink a cup of coffee and kind of peer up at the trees for a little bit. So I think that's part of it too, is just kind of knowing personally that you're always going to get something out of the experience. You don't have to see a single bird, and yet it could be the impetus for some kind of spiritual or personal growth within you.
Sure. It could, like you mentioned, when you went up to the mountain to see the monument of the passenger pigeon, sometimes you don't see any birds, and sometimes you need to be reminded what the world would be like with no birds.
Right. And I think there's a line in there about, you know, the absence was deafening, you know, it really feels that way. I think sometimes the first thought is, oh, I'm disappointed I didn't see any birds today. But also maybe the other way to think about it is I'm a little alarmed I didn't see any birds today, you know. And Steve Bechtel talked about the martin and how he used to see martins all the time, purple
right.
martins in Wisconsin. And he just doesn't see them that often anymore in his lifetime, you know. And that's really, it's scary for a guy like me because it makes me wonder, if I'm too late, if my son is certainly too late, like what can we do to keep these birds around a little longer? And, you know, there are things we can do.
Right. And Steve says that it's necessary to know what to look for before you even get there. That's kind of his mentorship that you see throughout the book with you learning birds. And I mean, I can understand how it's difficult for people to understand that it's not just seeing with your eyes. I mean, everyone can see. If they can see, they can see. Mm-hmm. But knowing with your mind is really what you need. And to me, it paralleled a lot with writing. How do you explain to someone with writing that it's not just if you can write and you can create your letters and you can put some words and sentence together and language, but it's this imagination of crafting something to read. Like finding a bird isn't just about being able to see, but knowing the bird before you see it.
Yeah, there's a lot of preparation that goes into both of those, you know, and it's not like, you know, as a writer, I don't just sit down and have at it. I mean, certainly I'd like that to be the case, but there's so much reading and thought that goes on behind the scenes. And same with birding. When you do it right, when you do it the Steve Bechtel way and the way he certainly taught me, you know, you spend a lot of time looking through bird books. You spend a lot of time knowing your geography and understanding what birds are likely to inhabit that geography. I mean, that way you don't have to look through an entire bird book to figure out what you're seeing. Just look at the region. If you can understand your region, that's going to really help you narrow down what you're looking at, you know. And so even within different types of terrain in a region, you know, on a prairie, for instance, versus a, you know, a mountainous region, you're going to see very different birds. And so when he travels, and certainly as I begin to travel a bit more, I try to get a sense of the landscape. And from that, what birds might inhabit that landscape. And writing sort of the same way, you know, you got to figure out what challenges you might have in front of you, mm-hmm. and then kind of figure out how to work around those challenges.
Through preparation.
I mean,
for your book, obviously, the archiving, research, the interviewing, the field work that you did, and then getting out there.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a two-part thing. I think preparation is key. You need to get yourself in the right place. But then once you get there, I think you also have to be willing to let go of the plan altogether. And that's sort of the other part of it, too. You've got to get to the archive, but you've got to be able to kind of take the blinders off and look for the piece of paper you didn't even know was out there. Or in the birding world, you know, get to the mountaintop and then keep your eyes wide enough to see something flash across your field of vision that, you know, may just be an ivory-billed woodpecker. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely sounds like those parallels paired perfectly with writing and birding. I really appreciated what Steve said, that birding becomes more difficult the more you do it. And because it's kind of a zero-sum game, right? There's only so many birds out there, and there's unfortunately less and less. And I wonder, do you think that difficulty of birding pairs, or maybe it diverges with writing?
Oh, that's, I think, the most perfect example of those pairing together. I mean, I have so many, you know, younger students in an intro-level creative writing class. Oftentimes, the writing is really easy for them, and it's a lot of fun. You know, we don't have to agonize it. They're just kind of doing it for the first time, and that's awesome, and they're excited about it. But as you move up, you know, and suddenly you're at a 400-level workshop, it's so difficult, you know, because now we know all their options. We know there's a million ways to get this wrong and maybe one or two ways to get it right, and so it's kind of anxiety driving in a lot of ways. And that's just like birding, you know. I mean, after you've seen so many, you're only left with the hard stuff. There's all the easy stuff has been taken care of. Now you only have tough decisions ahead.
Right. And you have to teach them how to prepare and get them in that place, but then also lose that expectation though.
Yes, that's exactly what my entire kind of writing career, if I could call it a career, has been based on, you know, like do your research, do your homework, talk to everyone you can, read every book you can, but then also be willing to look out your window one night and see a rabbit getting chased by a great horned owl and wake your son and see what comes of that too. You know, you have to live your life with blinders off. That's what I often tell my students.
Right. And I'd like to close by asking this question, and I'd really like to hear about you. We spoke a little bit about what the purpose of the book is, and you asked this tough question to Paula Holohand, the curator of the Zoological Museum at the University of Wisconsin. I mean, you basically asked her, does it all matter? Or what does it all matter? And I know it matters, you know, but what do you want this book to tell people who can't list more than cardinals, sparrows, crows, owls, eagles? What's the purpose of this book? What will this book do for our future after the past extinctions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for me, the way I like to phrase it and the way I like to talk about it is I often say, you know, the book's bigger than birds. And certainly birding is an entry point into the natural world. But the title Flock Together is meant to imply that there's a direct connection between birds and humans, because I think there is. You know, a lot of studies have shown that the more that we lose our birds, the more bad news we have for humans, you know. And so birds, generally speaking, are kind of the proverbial kind of canary in the coal mine, you know. Certainly canaries were used to, you know, let miners know when there were some noxious gases down in the mines, and I think they're still being used in that capacity just in the larger world. You know, the rate at which extinctions are continuing is disconcerting, and certainly I'm not the guy to maybe sound all the alarms, but as just an every person, as just someone who walks his dog around the block and occasionally raises his binoculars, there's some things that we can do better, you know, and I think we've kind of reached that pivotal moment where we kind of have to decide what we value in this world, and if it's nature, if we do value the world itself, then how do we get to know it better? So I'm hoping that this book could inspire other folks like me, you know, amateurs, beginners, to mm-hmm. introduce themselves or reintroduce themselves with the world around them. I think back to being a kid looking for that dodo bird in the backyard. You know, I wouldn't dream of doing something so silly today, but I kind of wish I would dream of that. And not only that, I wish I'd be willing to give it another crack. You know, I think we lose that imagination. And that's part of the reason why I went to extinct animals. I like to think, if we look hard enough, maybe we won't see what we're looking for, but we might find something else beautiful along the way.
Right. Well, BJ Hollers, thank you so much for being on Book Central with me today.
Thank you so much.
BJ Hollers is the author of the new book, Flock Together, A Love Affair with Extinct Birds. Thank you for listening to Book Central. I'm Chris Uviora, and this is KHOI in Ames.
Buggy breaks and go careening down the mountain to the wind tunnel of fate. We have grass stains on our eyes from all the world we have to see. In cities like some fool's crush, we love and then we leave. I am one wall, you are two walls, we are three walls a house. I am one wall, you are two walls, we are three walls a house. My antique spirit is my living room, my heart, my leather couch. I strike the tambourine against my hip, then I hit the road again. The folks who brave the bravest risks, and I bet they never had no accident. You set a course for the world's end. You'll find the end is endless as the darkness and the ocean and the panicking Titanic when it sinks in. Ah, forever is a very long time when it sinks in. Ah, forever is a very long time. And trains and face the body of my fears. Ring a bell around my neck to let your jingle harp be near. I could lay inside your love for me like a tiny raft in a tiny stream. On time, my name would be known only as the Ellis Islands you see in me. We can flee to little Egypt, to a garden by the lake. You lynch tomatoes, I'll kill chickens. We knew all of them by name. Plant a sunset, I watch a tree, I hold your hand when it gets stark. But the purple sun is just another star, the earth, another yard, and then it sinks in. Our forever is a very long time to let it sink in. Our forever is a very long time. Quitting drinking, take the bottles off of the fridge, out of the cupboard and the chimney, streets and stranger places hid. I will collect them into bags, collect the bags into a can, which I will place beside the house where the garbage meets the garbage man. Look at them in there, they're different shapes, they're different colors, like a sack of seven heads, a new and old are lovers. It's too soon to say goodbye. I miss your hands on my insides and the way your gentle fingernails would scratch the back of my mind. I will not take you to the street tonight. I will have you one more time, like silver fillings to a cavity, babe. I'm yours, you are mine. Let's let it sink in. Our forever is a very long time to let it sink in. Our forever is a very long time. Forever is a very long time.